rosy light. Tescunul bidur rubau al rimal. Wahawaki leysa yakfu al jamal. Huma fi al ruhi sha'arun.
I don't ever do introductions or anything, but it's easier when a guest returns because people know who you are, or at least in my head, people know who you are and people can just go back and check who you are. And I don't really do intros anyways, but Gabriel, welcome back to the show. I'm going to do one anyways. We're here to talk about your really controversial, let's say, article on the CIA and the Frankfurt School. Here's the title. Let me read it out now. The CIA and the Frankfurt School's Anti-Communism, published in the Philosophical Salon, which is a section of the LA Review of Books. So it just came out a few days ago. We've talked about it a little bit. We kind of, in our last episode, I really recommend people go and check it out if they haven't listened. We kind of laid out these things at a pretty abstract level. We didn't get into like a lot of details, I feel. I mean, I joke the whole time that it was a therapy episode, which was like me, you know, like not jokingly, and it was actually very earnest, talking about how like I was coming to terms with a lot of the kind of supposedly radical figures who kind of shaped my thinking and influenced me and influenced this show. But also when you sort of look at like their political record with the things they said politically on like, you know, controversial issues of their day, which is a valid way of assessing them. Like, it's not some controversial way. Like, it's a, you know, what people say about issues says something about them and they're thinking, whatever. So this basic act of like looking into the deeper stuff of like who these people were and represent, you know, it never really struck me. And I feel like that last episode was me kind of like thinking out loud of like, wow, how come I just never questioned that? Like, how come I never thought about these things or like where positions they took? How come this didn't come up in our seminars? Anyways, like I think this episode will be more sticking to the facts kind of situation, because this article is a lot of names and it's a lot of details, but it's also perfect for a podcast episode because it is kind of focused in on a specific character and it's not kind of looking at theory. I mean, the last episode we had was kind of on French theory, and this is more obviously it's German founding fathers, which is a term you use, which I want to talk about. But we're here to talk about this article. It's a fantastic piece. First off, but before we get into it, can you just describe what the Frankfurt School is, the so-called Frankfurt School, and why they're so important? Because some people may not have heard their name before.
Yeah, for sure. And thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the great work that you're doing. The Frankfurt School consists of a group of German intellectuals who came together in the interwar period, you know, between First World War and Second World War in Germany, and they were able to obtain funding from Felix Weil, who was the son of a capitalist millionaire who had made a lot of money from the grain enterprise in Argentina, but also was involved in property speculation and meat trading. And so that was the kind of financial backing for what became known as the Institute for Social Research, or the Frankfurt School. And the group that kind of coalesced early on was really interested in raising what is, I think, a really important historical question, and that is, why, if the Russian Revolution of 1917 succeeded, why did the revolution not spread westward, and in particular to Germany, which of course it did to a certain extent, but the German Revolution in the wake of 1917 wasn't successful at a national level because of the crushing of the Spartacus League and other things that we could talk about if you wanted to. And so the Institute came together as a kind of Marxist think tank of sorts to grapple with the legacy of the failed revolution in the West and in the capitalist core on the one hand, and then it quickly became preoccupied with the issue of the rise of fascism, right? So instead of a revolution, you have the Nazi rise to power. And the very first generation, then a lot of them went into exile in the United States, and they became prominent in the kind of broader Anglophone world in, you know, this began in the 1960s, even 1950s to a certain extent, but then they really exploded later on in the 20th century and became canonical references in what I would call a kind of radical theory within the capitalist core, and given how much the capitalist core tends to dominate, at least institutionally, some of the kind of echo chambers globally through colonialism and neocolonialism, they've been a really central reference point and school for radical theory, or what some people would call Western Marxism. Others will call it cultural Marxism, because of an investment in culture and art as a site of potential social transformation. And the major figures that we're talking about here, Max Horkheimer was the director of the Institute for years. He worked closely with Theodore Adorno, who's one of the other leading figures. Your viewers and listeners have probably heard of Herbert Marcuse. Of course, Walter Benjamin was associated with the Institute until his untimely death. And there's a number of other figures, Pollock and Neumann, et cetera. So it's a broad group. But those who are most visible are definitely Adorno, Horkheimer, and Marcuse.
So before we get into the actual article, I did want to kind of continue a kind of question that I started last time. And we never really resolved, I don't think. I mean, you can really, they're like kind of irresolvable, but like all my questions, but in the sense that the part of your approach in these kind of articles and in this kind of, you know, I would call it a kind of debunking project that you're on, like a mission, a holy war, if you will, that like you're challenging the position of these well-known radical thinkers, like capital R, capital T, and asking the basic question of like, you know, what were their politics, so to speak, like capital P politics, the way that we put in like modern parlance, like where did they stand on the issues, like where? So that to me, there's, you know, you make this point in the article about separating the thinker from their time or their position, right? I think I have the quote right here. The analysis that follows is based on a dialectical account of the social totality that situates the subjective theoretical practices of these two founding fathers of critical theory within Adorno, Adorno and Horkheimer, within the objective world of international class struggle, and does not accept the arbitrary dividing line that many petty bourgeois academics desperately try to erect between intellectual production and the broader socioeconomic world, as if someone's, quote, thought could and should be separated from their, quote, life, as well as from the material system of theoretical production, circulation, and reception that I will here refer to as the intellectual apparatus. Such a non-dialectical assumption, after all, is little more than a symptom of an idealist approach to theoretical work, which presumes that there is a spiritual and conceptual realm that functions completely independently of material reality and the political economy of knowledge. Okay, that's a big mouthful, but you kind of lay out like the gambit of the article, at least the kind of like chassis of the article, of like you have to hold these people, you have to like test these people's politics, stress test them in a sense, is that you have to see what they said about these divisive issues. And this is, you know, for me, what the and I agree with this approach, at least in theory, one way to test that is to see what they say on the Palestine question. And before this interview, there's a lot of interesting things to be found with the word Israel in the Frankfurt School guy's writings, and I have a collection of them in German, and maybe we can quote from them. But I did want to push back a little bit and say to play the devil's advocate of your question, of the kind of opening gambit, which is to say, like, who's to say that people who aren't as critical of you as you are of these guys and their politics, who's to say that they do that, that they separate the thought from the thinker, right? And so if that's like somewhat of an old school approach in the sense of like, say, in the case of someone like Heidegger, right? Like the Heidegger is I think in some ways a kind of prime example of someone who gets to have their thoughts separated from their so-called life, their subject, like biographical life, so to speak. I mean, in the sense that like this was a person who was like a high-ranking Nazi philosopher who like contributed to the like Nazi project. And he's like a foundational figure in modern philosophy. And that is not a contradiction in liberal like academic, in like the world of liberal academia. That's not a contradiction, right? Like that's not a that's not some Gordian knot you can't untie. Like, it makes sense, actually. Yeah. And so, like, that in a sense is like, you could defend them. I guess there's that, like, they didn't separate it. But maybe I would say that, like, where is there another group of intellectuals who do talk about biography, at least in the case of someone like, especially in the case of someone like the Benjamin, right, whose biographical kind of, who's the tragedy of his life, so to speak. I mean, the other guys had like some tragic things in their life happen too, but the fact that it ended so early and the thing, although there are the people who say he was assassinated and all that. But like, aside from like Benjamin, who's kind of like, you know, I would say kind of mourned as a kind of secular martyr to these guys, that like he was like, you know, which is fine, whatever, let's have people feel. But like, that these, that the Frankfurt School guys have resisted the kind of biographical critique that, say, like Foucault has received. Like, a lot of the personal life of Adorno, of these guys, is less well known. And I think what would be your response to someone who's like, who's questioning that opening gambit, like, in the sense that, like, you know, it's not just the people who separate that. Like, I can come to terms with who Adorno was. And in fact, it makes sense to me that this guy who was persecuted by the Nazis would turn towards the US.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question, because it goes to the heart of what I take to be a very significant issue, and that is how bourgeois culture in general functions. If it be about intellectuals, artists, cultural producers, musicians, etc., there is a tendency, but it's only a tendency, it's not universal or functions in 100%, but a tendency to separate the kind of spiritual cultural product from the producer. And this is a result of the consolidation of bourgeois culture within kind of contemporary capitalist society, and is bound up with a whole series of assumptions about how culture is produced. Namely, that there are these individual geniuses who tap into some transcendent realm that they can then channel. It's very spiritual. This is very religious. I mean, the religious motifs, I think, should be transparent, right? The ways in which bourgeois culture repackages so many elements from, in particular, there, you know, what's referred to as the Judeo-Christian tradition, but there are other religious elements that are there. And that what's important then is the product, independently of the life of the producer. And Heidegger himself said the biography of a great thinker should basically be composed of three sentences. He was born, he thought, and he died. Right, so all biography is completely unimportant and set aside in the name of the spiritual product, right? This process of understanding what bourgeois culture is a historical product that's bound up with capitalist social relations, that is the result also of intellectual property law and the attempt to monetize these particular products and give them higher symbolic value than other products, so that then they can be leveraged also for economic value in various ways. Now, in pushing back against that, of course, there are intellectual historians, there are biographers, and other people who are really interested in these issues. So I wouldn't say that like everyone who engages in bourgeois culture suffers from this problem, and that's kind of what you're pointing out. But what I would say is that the approach that I'm advocating for is not simply, well, we need more biography and we need more intellectual history, which I bring to the table because I've read all the biographies, or at least the standard ones, and the intellectual history and things like this. What I'm interested in is an analysis of the social totality. And what that necessitates is breaking down the borders between any of these different disciplines or these genres or these types of approaches, so that you put someone's entire theoretical practice within the larger context within which they're operating, which includes not only, you know, Germany and the United States in the case of the figures that we're talking about, but most importantly, at the most macro level, international class struggle. Where are they situated in relationship to the capitalist system on the one hand that is destroying the conditions of possibility of existence on planet or Earth and rapidly destroying just the conditions of life for so many people around the world, versus the attempt to bring into being in various ways with fits and starts and complications and difficulties a socialist socioeconomic order? And that really basic question, for me, it's simple. It should be kind of the question that we raise in kindergarten, like, oh, are these people contributing to a life project that is sustaining for humanity and the biosphere, or are they lining up on this other project that has been destroying planet Earth and humanity for centuries. That really basic question isn't raised in my experience and in my academic training. Instead, there's an insistence that you can only begin to raise critical questions if you ponder the products of the thinker for years and years and years, and you spend time in the archive, and then you become basically an Adorno specialist. Well, you've never actually raised the most fundamental question. Is the person that you're a specialist of someone who's contributing to the project of the emancipatory project of a more egalitarian and ecologically sustainable society, or are they not? And of course, there's grays. You know, this is not, you know, I think there's a lot of black and white, but there's also gray zone. There's people who contribute or contribute up to a certain point or up to a certain level. And I point that out in the article, right? Adorno and Horkheimer were critics of consumer society and the culture industry, and there's value in some of what they say. But that value has to be contextualized in relationship to what they say about socialism. And what they say about socialism is, in short, that it's a lot worse than capitalism. So as bad as consumer society is, actually existing socialism is a lot worse. And that's why I refer to their theoretical contribution as being a form of a BS theory. It's anything but socialism, right? And so it's that larger context that, again, is an unbelievably simplistic question. And I'm proud of it being said, not that it's just my own question. It's the question of a lot of people. Like, what side are you on and what are you contributing to? Because we have a limited amount of time to solve the problems that are facing humanity.
Well, so we should get into like the meat of the article in the sense that, and I think at the outset, I mean, one of the things that you do is to situate the work of the Frankfurt School in the broader context of the very raging ideological Cold War, ideological war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union for what could be called the left, the international left, right? And I use the word left here specifically, which is a term that I actually don't like, but it's a useful way of exploring the fact that, like, yeah, there was this turn towards communism in the 20th century, and the U.S. was one of the leading forces in many different ways, fighting back against it using every tool possible. And this, and you know, in some ways, we talk about the Cold War as if it's something that kicks off in 1945, but like the ideological war on communism begins long before that, and it's part of like the American settler colonial culture, right? That like right wing anti-communism is in its blood. That's why it attracts right-wing anti-communists of all kinds, of all shades and nationalities to its shores. And that's why there's all these like compradors that just exist, you know, in some cube somewhere, and they're just summoned out whenever there's some protest in Cuba or something, whenever they're needed. So like that's, the U.S. does play that role. And the fact, and I think that's where we should probably begin to situate the Frankfurt School guys, is that these guys were to use a bad metaphor, like ground zero of like the Cold War, in the sense that like they were elite figures trained at like the top echelons of their society. They were refugees arriving to the shores of first the UK, at least in the case of Adorno. I know that Adorno left Germany, then he went to the UK for a while. He didn't really suit him. And then he ended up going to New York. Then he ended up going to LA. And I think that was his trajectory. And I think I'm pretty sure Max Horkheimer was already, I can't remember his trajectory, I don't really care. But
yeah,
like
he went through New York
know,
into California
you know,
too. Yeah.
Right. So like they were exceptional in a lot of ways, right? I mean, I don't know if this gets discussed that often, but we certainly didn't talk about it. Is that like there are a lot of people who were trying to get in the US who weren't as special as they are. And it should, you know, and the fact that like these guys survived is a testament to like their rank and privilege in society, in German society,
100%.
And like what was a valued member. So like these are just material facts of their existence that, you know, that we should sort of at any stage of the matter sort of like throw into the mix. But maybe we could kind of situate their lives at that point, is that these guys were on the ground as this like intense ideological war between communism so-called and capitalism so-called, when they were kind of like ideally situated to become good, you know, intellectual commanders of that.
Yeah, I think that context is so important to understand, because a lot of the Western intelligentsia has been largely unconsciously or subconsciously indoctrinated into a kind of mainstream anti-communism. And actually, first and foremost, I'll put myself in that pool. I was educated at some of, you know, for what it's worth, very prestigious institutions. And those institutions trained me to be absolutely 100%, if not 200%, ignorant about every form of actually existing socialism anywhere in the world, and to traffic in the worst and most ignorant stereotypes regarding every single aspect of those societies, coupled with the idea that you could make these slanderous statements about entire peoples, entire segments of the world. China is this, Russia is that, Vietnam is this, Cuba is that, without ever having cracked a book, gone to visit, studied anything, just because that is the dogma of the Western intelligentsia. What's interesting, though, if you begin to look into where that dogma comes from, it wasn't organically or spontaneously produced. It was manipulated very, very directly by the bourgeois states within the imperialist core. In particular, Great Britain with MI6 on the one hand, and the United States with the CIA on the other. And these are only some of the agencies. There are many others, USAID, USAID, you know, they go on. It's alphabet soup of agencies. And they're propaganda agencies that had as one of their goals to shore up the compatible left. And this was a very smart tactic, because what it meant was they recognized that, and a lot of the people who were working in these operations within the CIA were Ivy League trained. These were highly educated people who went to the most prestigious institutions. And they understood if you were just doing the Fox News kind of anti-communist garbage all of the time, you weren't actually going to be able to get the job done for certain segments of the population. And so their operations were much more sophisticated. What they did is they funded, supported, promoted internationally the compatible left, meaning the non-communist left. And they did this through front organizations like the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was an enormous enterprise. They had, you know, offices in some 35 countries. They were running dozens of prestige magazines. They had Forum Service, which was a press service, where they were pumping out information to news outlets, you know, so-called news outlets, propaganda outlets around the world. The Information Research Department of MI6 in Great Britain was doing basically the same thing. And then they began working with the CIA. And so these were enormous propaganda endeavors. And what they were particularly interested in was cultivating within the intelligentsia the dissenting intellectuals who purportedly knew something about Marxism, socialism, and communism, but had broken with it and instead had lined up on either a pro-capitalist orientation in certain instances, like Raymond Aron and other famous cases, or at a minimum, they were just still highly critical of any form of actually existing socialism. And just so that your viewers and listeners know, like, this is all part of the public record. I've been to a lot of archives and done Freedom of Information Act requests and gotten additional information that's not easily accessible. But the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the Information Research Department, there are books and books and books written about this, tons of internal documents, tons of testimony on the part of those who are actually involved in these endeavors, including Thomas Braden, who oversaw a lot of these operations in Western Europe. And so the Frankfurt School, much like French theory, because this is connected to the earlier conversation that we had, Western Europe was seen as really one of the core fronts in the intellectual world war. Germany, France, Italy, Great Britain, to a certain extent Spain, were seen as the places where a wedge had to be driven between what was identified, correctly or incorrectly, as a kind of communist intelligentsia or anti-colonial intelligentsia. Sartre, de Beauvoir, Brecht, Fanon, these were the enemies, right? Because they insisted on a radical social transformation in the direction of anti-colonial liberation and with some elements of socialism. And again, you know, even within those four figures, there are disagreements and things like that, over and against the people they wanted to shore up. And who they wanted to shore up were the people that I refer to as the radical recuperators, the people who appear radical, like Horkheimer and Adorno, But actually, at the end of the day, if you mine down into their work, what you find out is that they're interested in recuperating the radical potential of the youth and student movement, of the workers' movement, of the anti-colonial movement, within the kind of hand-wringing liberal fold in which you say, yes, capitalism is horrible and everything's awful and they're controlling my thoughts when I buy toothpaste and they're constructing my desires, a lot of which is true. But then you say, well, what's the solution to that? And with Adorno and Horkheimer, Adorno is very clear, despair is the only thing that can save us. So there's a kind of petty bourgeois indulgence in melancholia as an ersatz for actually getting invested in structural transformation or change. And so it's not surprising when you step back and you look at it from that perspective, you say, well, why is it that the most well-known Marxists within the capitalist core happen to be radical recuperators? And once you begin to see it, you say, well, of course that makes sense. Are they going to be promoting people like Lenin or Ho Chi Minh or Chairman Mao? No, of course not. Fidel Castro? Forget about it. Absolutely not. These people are to be assassinated, right? The other people, though, can be recuperated within this particular project. And a final thing that I'll say on that, because unfortunately in writing essays like this, which are related to a book project, a lot of people just have a fundamental misunderstanding about how all of these operations work. So they think that Adorno was there and somebody in the CIA came with a briefcase and handed off some dollar, and then there was a 007 agent who knocked on the door, things like this. Basically, their vision of how these operations functioned is based more on Hollywood and ultimately on psyops on the part of the national security state, which is very involved in Hollywood. National Security Cinema is a great book on this topic, and there's lots of others. That's not how this works. What they do is, you know, there are many different tactics, but one of the principal tactics is a metaphor that I've used before, is that instead of having people on marionette strings, which is very complicated and can be discovered easily, they build marionette theaters. They fund them. They support them. They put so much money into them that they become the premier institutions of their day. And then the marionettes come of their own free will. You don't need the strings. Nobody sees the strings attached, because all you have is a free intellectual who happens to have received an enormous grant from the U.S. government, the Rockefeller Foundation, doing work that's labeled as Marxist, that's actually pitted against any form of actually existing socialism. That's how the larger operation works. And that's how what we have to see. We have to see it for the objective reality that it is, and not get hung up on, and this is another problem I think that some people have in reading some of my work, is they get hung up on the subjectivism of it. Like, oh, he's saying bad things about people that I like and other such things. That's not the point. This isn't a smear campaign or something about, you know, wanting to bring people down. It's about wanting to get clear about objective reality so that we can all figure out how we're situated in relationship to that objective reality. And I don't say that I have perfect access to objective reality. What I say is that I've been doing a lot of research for decades and decades, and it all points in the same direction. And it also is corroborated by a whole series of other historians whom I've read on the topic who are saying very similar things. So if you read Nestor Cohan, if you read Domenico Lasordo, if you read Annie Laquaris, you'll find people who are saying very, very similar things. So there's a confluence of scholars around these particular themes, which for me demonstrates that this isn't an individual endeavor that I'm on. It's a scientific and collective endeavor. And if people open their minds up, then they can look at the evidence themselves, analyze it, and decide where they stand on these issues. Instead of doing the subjective hot take of, oh, this is ridiculous, or he just wants, you know, attention or something like that.